And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Born during the despair of the Great Depression, tempered by the fires of the Second World War, on a parallel Earth very much like our own, yet slightly different, they're banded together the greatest forces for freedom ever assembled. Over the many ensuing years, new and younger members would join the veteran champions of the Golden Age, continuing their fight for truth, justice, and the American way. Becoming so much more than just heroes, they became legends. Back to the Bins proudly presents Legends of the Justice Society of America.
Hello and welcome to Back to the Bins. My name is Scott Gardner and I am joined in this episode by my very good pals, Paul the Producer Spataro.
Hello.
Or should it be Paul the Slacker? No, I guess I couldn't be Paul the Slacker because you did end up writing your synopsis. I was going to give you crap.
But it was under protest. I'm having to have original thoughts.
And also David A. Pascarella.
Hey, how are you? Good.
Excited for this. All right, so for this episode, we are continuing our brand new sub-feature of the show called Legends of the Justice Society of America. So this is our third and final preamble before we get to the actual JLA-JSA crossovers. That will be next episode. So this is yet another issue of The Flash, where the two Flashes meet up, and we get some interesting developments in this particular one. But for all the details and all the fun on this one, I'm going to pass it off to Paul for the details and the synopsis.
Yes, and as you two are aware, but our listeners are not, under protest, I have written out a synopsis for this issue. Because for reasons that I can't fathom, Scott has decided he is an anti-plagiarism guy and does not want me to just steal the database descriptions. I stand tall on my database theft and will continue to do so in the future. But this once I did succumb to his pressure to write out a synopsis.
Can I ask a question before you start? Did you actually read the book to summarize it, or did you summarize the summary that you found online? Just out of curiosity.
That would be a good way to go. I actually read their summary, then read the book, and then did my synopsis.
Cliff notes first, huh?
You know, sometimes when I don't have as much time, I do find if I read the synopsis first and I know where it's going, I just go through it faster, which is not always the best way to do it. But I do find that sometimes it makes it easier for me to sit and take in some of the stupidity of the story or some of the better artwork in the story or some of the bad artwork in the story, whatever it may be. I'm more noticing it than when I'm just reading the book on its own. So I do find reading a synopsis beforehand often helps me to just kind of gather my thoughts and do it as an analysis of the book rather than just reading it for pleasure, if that makes any sense.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes I think, well, that synopsis was pretty good, and then I just want to read it for the episode and save myself the time.
I just want to defend myself a little bit. I'm not doing it to be a dick or to be a martinet, but I mean,
those things just happen naturally.
It's really just for two reasons. Is for one, primarily, it's because, and you know, this happens a lot, that you know we'll go with a canned synopsis, you know, somewhere, you know, we find somewhere, and then we spend half the synopsis going, ooh, that's clunkily worded, or who the hell wrote this, or wow, they left out this part, or that's not what happened, you know, that sort of thing. So, you know, we often go into them kind of blind and like, wow, this synopsis sucks. There's that. But then also, I like having like our take. So then that way you can inject your own humor, you can inject your own take, you know, that sort of thing. So it's actually coming from us. And that was kind of my thought behind
it. I honestly do not disagree with you, but I still do have a full-time job, and sometimes it's hard to actually sit down and write a synopsis. I apologize to our listeners that I can't clear up more of my day every time to do more. But sometimes that is a problem. But I am planning on retiring in the next 2 years. So I think if I'm still doing this after I retire, I will do my own synopsises on every book. The other thing is sometimes I feel if I do a synopsis off the cuff, it's a little clunky. So I do like having the pre-written ones when possible. And sometimes I use the ones I pre-write, and sometimes I use the ones someone else did. If that seems unfair, I apologize to all the listeners everywhere for their burden that I put upon them.
When he retires, we'll be able to move over to YouTube, that he'll have so much time, we can make it a video production.
That would be nice, because I was just gonna do this. I mean, now the listeners can't see this, obviously. We all can see each other, but obviously this is a podcast and not, you know, a video show or anything. But I just wanted to show this off.
Scott has the book in hand, whereas Dave and I are working off scans of the book.
This is the first of many.
Well, no, Dave is working off a trade paperback. Excuse me.
But yeah, this is the first of hopefully many of the ones that we're going to cover for this segment, where I actually have the physical book. And I got that one not too long ago, just before it blew up. Because a lot of these books I'm noticing have suddenly blown up on the back market. So
they're asking crazy prices for the facsimile ones.
Yeah.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, $20 for a facsimile?
Right.
I recently popped into a show, and they're asking stupid prices for, like, first appearances of characters that nobody should care about anymore. You know, because, oh, they appear on the show or they appear in this movie, but they're not big-name characters. And I'm trying to remember. I saw one. It was the first appearance of somebody who was in the Eternals movie. It was Marvel Superheroes number 17 or 18, with the Black Knight.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I saw it. I mean, it was in very, very good shape. So I give some points to the price they're charging for that. But they were charging like over $100, because that was the first solo appearance of the Black Knight. And all I could think was, yeah, but who cares?
Right.
You know, I mean, the Black Knight is not a pivotal character that everybody's got to worry about.
Right.
So I didn't really get that. And then it's funny, because I was on eBay and I was looking and I found one, you know, not in as good shape, but I bought one for $10. Like, that's what that book should go for.
Right.
Now, yeah, that's been happening a lot. The only book I have left of the Marvel Superheroes original issues, and I'm not interested really in the reprint ones, but all the originals that they came out with for issues 12 through 20, I think it was. The only one that remains on my want list is, I believe, number 20, which is a Doctor Doom solo story. And now I'm seeing that going for stupid money. I thought that would be a $20 book, honestly.
Yeah, no, I've been seeing that happening a lot, because one of the apps that I subscribe to, let me see, I forget what the name of it is here, but it's one that, Key Collector. You know, it gives you alerts on when books suddenly get hot and that sort of thing. And a lot of the stuff that they're marking as hot right now is because, you know, something gets announced with some TV or film deal, and all of a sudden, you know, these characters blow up. And it's not always the big characters you expect, like Superman, Spider-Man, Batman. It's sometimes like Z-listers, and it's like, that's a 50-cent book, and all of a sudden it's, you know, stupid expensive. And yeah, it's crazy how that stuff happens. But and it's been happening more and more often all the time.
Yeah, I had a book, Fantastic Four number 94, was, I saw it for stupid money, because it's the first appearance of Agatha Harkness. I was like, Really? Well, is that such a pivotal issue that people have to pick up?
What were they asking for that?
It was like $90.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I understand first appearance of Thanos goes for a lot of money. First appearance of Darkseid goes for a lot of money. But, you know, not every run-of-the-mill character, just because they're on screen, should go for significant money.
Right. Right. And that's the exact sort of thing that's been happening. You know, like first appearance of Cyclone. It's like, who cares?
Yeah.
Does anybody even know who that is? You know,
it irritates me, because and it's not even, you know, there's characters where I understand they'd be popular and it would bump up the price somewhat, but it bumps it up to a point of being ridiculous on some of them. Like, for example, the first appearances of Blade or Moon Knight, who I think are, you know, they're popular characters. I can understand why their first appearance would have a higher value than the regular issue, but they shouldn't be in the hundreds of dollars.
Right, yeah.
They should be, you know, like if that run of Tomb of Dracula has issues around it going for, say, $20 each, maybe that should go for 50 because it's the first appearance of Blade. But it shouldn't be $350 or crazy money like that.
Somebody just asked in one of the groups that I'm in on Facebook, somebody just asked, why is Tomb of Dracula number 10 so stinking expensive? And I said it was a conspiracy to keep me from having a complete collection of Tomb of Dracula because that's the only issue I don't have. And I'll be damned if I'm going to spend, you know, that kind of money for it. I mean,
yeah, like I said, if it was $50, $60 and you were complaining about it, I'd say, you know, you got to get over it.
Right.
But when we start talking hundreds of dollars, I don't see it. Same thing with Moon Knight. I don't see it.
And I can't remember the last time I saw a Tomb of Dracula in any condition that, you know, a number 10, I mean, first appearance of Blade that was under $100. And that's ridiculous.
Yeah,
I mean,
I agree.
Absolutely. I'm not paying that. So. But yeah, I mean, there's a long list of things like that when it comes to stupid expensive books.
Do you mind if we ask or tell the listeners what you paid for Flash 137?
Give me a second, I can tell you. It wasn't a whole lot, but it's been pretty pricey these days. So I'm glad I got it when I got it. I was kind of surprised because I just looked this up the other day, and it turns out I've had this. This is how long I've been planning on doing something like this because. I was just thinking, oh, I just recently got this book. No, I got this book like a year ago. So this is how long this whole thing has been in the works. So I got it August 20th, which was, you know, as we record, this was a little over a week ago. August 20th of last year, I paid with shipping and everything $31.95 for it.
That's very reasonable, actually.
Yeah.
That's even a little less expensive than I would expect. So,
yeah.
And you know, again, that's something where I would say if it was a $50 book, I'd be okay with it because of the age and significance of the crossover.
Yeah, this is a very significant book. And
as
a
$500 book or a $400 book or a $300 book or even a $150 book, I don't think it warrants it.
Right. And it's in really good shape, and I'd probably be really hard-pressed to get that same deal currently, because, like I say, these books are starting to blow up, so I got in on it just in time.
So now this, again, we're talking about Flash number 137, which has a cover date of June of 1963, and to those of you listening, only one of the people in this room was born when that happened. But still not old enough to read a comic book, although I probably wished I could. The cover, once again, kudos for showing a scene that's in the actual book.
Bonus point.
Has the two Flashes, each throwing a punch towards the face of the other. Or actually, it looks like they're actually connecting with each other's faces. While Vandal Savage is in the background flying off a la Superman pose. And it says, a new double flash thriller, Vengeance of the Immortal Villain, which is the title of our story. It's written by Gardner Fox, penciled by Carmine Infantino, inked by East Meadow's own Joe Giella, lettered by Gaspar Saladino, and edited by Julie Schwartz. The splash page of our saga opens with Vandal Savage, who is billed as a man of doom and the most powerful villain to menace two Earths, riding in a miniature Hall of Doom and shooting rays at our respective Flashes. The actual story opens with a series of strange lights over Washington, D.C., causing a blackout and a halt of all machinery, followed by the same phenomena over five additional cities. Iris West tells Barry Allen the news, and Barry thinks that the cities in question ring a bell, but responds by walking Iris home. Rather than reach out to the other heroes who might be able to help, he decides to rush home and go through his comic book collection. Needless to say, this is what I would do in the same situation. Barry rereads his issues of All-Star Comics and concludes that the cities affected were the cities where members of the Justice Society of America lived, and comes to the obvious conclusion that he should travel to Earth 2 and visit the Flash of that Earth. Having done so before, Barry has no problem vibrating between dimensions and pops into the Garrick residence, where he finds Jay's wife, Joan, at home doing Lord knows what with Lord knows who. When Jay returns from his own dalliances, Barry explains to him what had happened, and Jay is surprised because, who would have thunk it, the same events are happening on Earth too, and the Justice Society members that live in those cities have all gone mysteriously missing. At that time, the strange lights appear over Keystone City, and both Flashes speed out to try and find their source. Once again, their brilliant plan is to just run and examine every square inch of the city, since the lights over the city must be coming from the ground and couldn't be coming from something like OS satellite. Anyway, it turns out that it is at ground level, and Jay falls victim to the trap, being encased in a transparent cube, a one-of-a-kind collector's item, mint in box, and he's ready to be transported off into the sky.
He's been slammed.
He was slapped, yeah. And being older, he probably has some wrinkled edges. He probably got like an 8.2. Witnessing this, Barry races off after the cube, manages to hop onto it, and smashes it open by hitting it with super speed, never considering the fact that they're now plummeting to their deaths. Buddy thinks fast and is able to lower the two of them to the ground gently by creating a wind vortex at super speed. Meanwhile, in a secret hideout within Mammoth Caves, longtime JSA villain Vandal Savage is revealed as the sinister villain behind the dastardly doings. Behind him are his mint collection of Golden Age heroes, just needing the Flash to complete the set. He's collected Dr. Midnight, Wonder Woman, Hawkman, the Atom, Johnny Thunder, and the Green Lantern, with no thought that this Earth has a Batman or Superman. Instead of worrying about them, he apparently used the technology created by his fellow Injustice League members to complete his scheme, but for some reason did not feel the need to include them in on the plot. He then recalls how 50,000 years ago he was a Cro-Magnon named Vandar Arr, when the energies of an exploding meteor somehow made him immortal, and he's lived out the centuries as sometimes a ruler, sometimes a warrior such as Genghis Khan, or as an advisor to Napoleon and Bismarck. Since he thinks that only the Flash can threaten him and that the rest of the world will roll over and let him rub his belly like a happy puppy, he sets out to capture the Flash. Soon he is hurtling in his flying laboratory towards the skylight machine outside Keystone City. Jay recognizes Savage, despite his new uniform that he designed in an effort to honor his triumph, and his very, very 70s permanent that shows that he's not only a man of the past, but a man of the future. Personally, I'm not sure that the clothes make the man is an appropriate expression, but whatever. Anyway, Savage hits him with a ray that causes him to become heavier. Talking about Jay, I'm sorry. I'm as bad as some of the other Synopsis people. And sink into the ground as if it was quicksand. But to his surprise, a second Flash comes to the rescue. No matter, Savage hits him with a beam that has reversed it to make him lighter, and he starts to float into the sky. Savage lassos him and pulls him along as like a kite on a string. In the next chapter, both Flashes attempt to escape their peril by vibrating free, which causes the floating lab to plummet to the ground. I don't know why, but it does. However, Savage manages to return to his base. The Flashes trace Savage back to his cave, where he uses a weapon that he usurped from Erdegaton that causes the two heroes to fight each other, once again seeing our cover image. After a skirmish, Barry defeats Jay because old. Savage then sets up a trap by putting up a hologram of himself in a setting that would trap the Flash into one of his cubes. Barry figures it out at the last moment and springs the trap without getting caught in it. Savage stupidly thinks, with no scientific basis, that because the Flash was moving so fast that he was invisible and remains invisible inside the cube. But no, he turns around and faces the Flash along with the now freed Justice Society and is taken into custody. With the fight over, Wonder Woman suggests that the heroes should prevent this from happening again by coming out of retirement and reuniting as the Justice Society once more. Barry then returns to Earth Numero Uno, where he calls Iris for a date, and hilarity ensues. And my first thought on this is, if Wonder Woman's the one who wants them to get back together, why is Black Canary there when they get back together and not her? But we'll save that for next issue.
Yeah, that's a good catch. That's a very good catch. I really enjoyed your synopsis. This is why I like when we do our own, because, I mean, you nailed it with the humor and the observations and everything, and you really nailed a number of my notes. You and I seem to notice a lot of the same things. I'll just throw out there that the Earths have not yet been given their official designations. We're calling them Earth 1 and Earth 2 because we know that's what they eventually become, but that hasn't happened yet. So they just refer to, like, the other Earth and stuff in the story. They don't actually use the terms Earth 1 and Earth 2 yet. So page 2, panel 3, this is where it says, moments later at the Pentagon, you've got these three military guys standing around, and, you know, they're talking about the lights and how it's, you know, zonked out the electricity. They're basically standing around in the dark, and one of them is actually holding a lit candle. The general here says, suppose an enemy attacks. We couldn't fire a gun to stop him. And I'm thinking, since when the hell do guns run on electricity?
Yeah, I thought the same thing. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I was trying to think, you know, is it stopping all locomotion? I mean, what's the deal? Yeah. And the guy holding the candle looks like the Lincoln Monument, by the way.
Yes, he does. Yes, he does.
It's funny. The day the earth stood still.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so.
Everything stops, all the cars, everything.
Right. Well, I understand the cars because there's a combustion engine. Like, there's a logic that kind of fits there, but a gun...
No, a gun
If you told me we could fire the gun, but the bullet wouldn't engage or something, that makes more sense to me than we can't fire a gun. I don't know.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
Well, I would just to play devil's advocate, I'm guessing, like, missile systems and... high artillery that, you know, has an electrical component, but I mean old-fashioned, you know, rifles and pistols.
Now I'm stuck with going to Monty Python and Eric Idle saying, but what if we go after him with a pointed stick? You know, it's like, you know, you have no defense. Okay, that's it.
I like on page 7, jumping way ahead here, page 7, panel 4, so... Jay has been encased, he's in his slab, and he's floating through the sky. It says, over Keystone City moves the odd cube racing up a building wall to intercept it, speeds Barry Flash. And this is weird, them calling him J Flash and Barry Flash. It should just be like Old Flash, New Flash or something. I don't know. It's just kind of weird. But anyway, he goes, whatever hope I have of stopping those skylights in my world will involve saving Flash first. I'm just thinking, you know, it's really nice to see that he has his priorities a little straighter this time around than last time, where it was like, gee, I'd like to help you save your entire planet, but I've got to deal with these two, you know, lower tier goons first. So, yeah, I like this, that he seems to have figured out, you know, the priorities here.
I'd like to help you save your planet, but we got a dinner reservation.
I got to get home to Iris. Right. And the power's out home, so no TV tonight.
Paul, you covered this one in your synopsis, but I had the same observation that this was not very smart of him to free Jay with no plan of what's going to happen once he shatters the cube, because as soon as he does, they just plummet to their death.
And the whole purpose of that, as best as I can tell, is to create just a little bit of, you know, a cliffhanger, so to speak, right. Because the story is broken up into chapters and they're plummeting to their deaths at the end of chapter number one. And then at the beginning of chapter number two, he does his vortex to save him. So if this was a Saturday morning serial, it would be much more effective.
Right.
And then Barry looks at Jay and says, I've always loved you.
This might be my favorite note. At page 12, last panel. So you've got, you've got Vandal Savage. He's sitting in his big red chair, his big red comfy chair. He looks, frankly, ridiculous with his big poofy fro. And he says, in a sense, I made them all immortals when I placed them in the cubes. They will witness my taking over the world, see my wicked triumphs, but completely helpless to stop me. To honor the occasion, I even designed this new uniform I'm wearing, and I could only hear the cowardly lion in my head going,
and I got a permanent just for the occasion.
Yeah, the hair really looks bad.
Yeah, it's silly. It is very silly.
And just, you know, I designed a new uniform for the occasion. What the hell are you thinking? Like, that's your concern? When I win, I need to have the right costume to wear.
Yep.
Maybe a little more time thinking about how to win and a little less time worrying about your outfit, and maybe you'd have some success, Mr. I've been alive for 50,000 years.
Right.
I did like, just to go, oh, well, we didn't get to it yet. Keep going.
So on page 14, second panel, is where it says, until today, having turned his great talents, we're talking about Vandal Savage, to a quest for Earth domination, Vandal Savage has begun his program by capturing six of the Justice Society members who had imprisoned him. And you kind of touched on this in your synopsis, too. So he's only seeking revenge on the specific society members that were involved in his incarceration in All-Star Comics number 37. That makes no sense, because there's other society members that would at the very least come snooping around wanting to know what happened to them, and at the most looking to free or avenge them, you know, should the, you know, they die or whatever. So yeah, that plan makes no sense.
But I mentioned Superman and Batman, but there's also Hourman, there's Black Canary, both of whom will appear in the next crossover.
The Spectre.
Yeah, Spectre should be probably higher on your list than anybody.
Yeah.
But if they, that six were the only ones who appeared in that issue, and that's the only issue he has, he doesn't know about the others.
He's been alive for 50,000 years. He's, you know, maybe you find a little time to read the paper. It's such a brilliant plan. And you know it's a brilliant plan because he's got a cigarette holder.
Yes. Yes.
So he makes Jay Garrick too heavy, and he's lassoed to a rope, which is attached to the flying lab ship, and he's underground, being towed underground, while Barry is lighter than air and being towed through the sky. And I'm like, wait, what? How the hell do you tow somebody underground? That makes no sense. How is that not killing him?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just, that made no sense to me. I couldn't quite figure that one out. Did you guys notice? I didn't read them, but I always like to look at the names in the letter call. And E. Nelson Bridwell actually had a letter in the letters column, and he won original art for it, which I thought was really cool.
At the time, they didn't think there was much value in original art.
Right. Yeah. Says a note from the editor says E. Nelson Bridwell is the proud possessor of the original artwork for The Threat of the Absent-Minded Professor, which I guess is a prior story, or maybe it's one of the other. Is there another story in this book? No, this is the only story in here, so it has to be a prior issue. But that's pretty cool. But yeah, they did that sort of thing back in the day. Page 20, panel 5. Yes, this was the where the cover is reenacted in the story. So again, bonus points, because it looks pretty much just like the cover too, which is really neat. So that's
just
the second
time. Not quite as detailed.
Yeah. But that's pretty cool. That's the second time in, you know, in these examinations that we're doing that's happened. I think that's pretty neat. Page 24. Yeah. This was boy. So the whole thing here with, okay, at the last moment, I noticed that your pupils were dilated, and so that you weren't. I was like, what? I mean, how do you even notice something like that at super speed? And why would you naturally come to the conclusion that, oh, that person can't be real because their pupils are dilated? Wait, what? That made no sense. And then what, you know, it compounds it by Vandal Savage then saying, I successfully trapped him, and he's invisible because he was moving so fast at the time I captured him that you couldn't see him. So now that he's captured, you still can't see him. I'm like, what? Do you hear yourself? Because that makes no sense whatsoever. the logic right there, the science. I mean, I know that, you know, these things are always very wonky with the science anyway, but even in comic book science, that does not work. Like at all. But overall, you know, the dopey ass conclusion aside and everything, you know, I think it's mitigated by the return of the JSA. That's pretty cool. You know, it's a shame we don't actually see. What's that?
I said that is the key to the issue, really.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
If this was just a crossover without having them all cubed up in their things and without having them released at the end, I don't know that I would rate it any higher than I did the last one.
Right. No, I agree with you. Yeah, I totally agree with you. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it better than the last issue. But at the end of the day, yeah, it would be kind of like, well, you know, it's just another kind of run of the mill, you know, Jay and Barry team up type of thing. But yeah, with the stakes being much higher and it's actually, you know, the Justice Society, that's pretty cool. And even though they don't really do all that much in the story, just to see them all together again, you know, at the end of the story and going
interacting. Yeah. Interacting as opposed to.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, maybe we should get back together. Yeah. It's cool.
And well, that was one of the things when they say Wonder Woman says, let's get back together. They're all in retirement at this point. Apparently they are so quick to, I'm in favor of it. Me too. It's like, nobody has to even give it a thought.
They want to get out of the house. Wait, in a couple of years, you'll be doing the same thing to us.
Well, that's because it's you.
Yeah, let's get the hell out of here.
You know, I would think, you know, I retire, and then even if I'm bored, I think it's going to take a little bit of thought before I'd say, yeah, I'll go back to work. I don't know. I have my doubts that'll ever happen.
Well, I like they want to find out about Barry, where he came from and all that. And it's, oh, we got to have a meeting. We better, you know, call it in to discuss it.
Put it on the agenda.
Put it on the agenda because, you know, we can't talk about it.
Unless first order of business. Anybody? Any new news? I don't feel the art in this book is as sharp as what we've seen in the, at least what we saw in the first one.
I agree.
Yeah.
I there's a lot of the line work that looks to be thicker than it needs to be.
Yeah.
And it creates almost like a noir effect on the people. Now, the one panel I do like it in is the one we already talked about with Abe Lincoln in it. That just looks kind of like creepy, and I like that.
Yeah.
Or even the panel above it, where the people are walking around with candles.
In the Pentagon.
Well, the one above it, they're out in the street.
Right. No,
and saying. Then the next one is in the Pentagon. Those two panels, I think, you know, effectively show, you know, the we have no power and it's nighttime and all of that. You know, why they chose Abe Lincoln for the shot, I don't know. But other than that, I think it's, you know, it's a pretty cool look. But otherwise, most of the panels in this book seem to have, Giella seems to have had like a little bit too much of a heavy hand with the inking. Although there are exceptions, I like the panel at the first panel, which is almost a splash page, of part two with Barry doing the vortex as they're falling. It almost looks like he's got his foot pressed up against the other panel and that he's using it to balance himself. And I just feel like it's a cool look because, you know, obviously he's not, but I think as a reader, it creates a feeling of stability for it. So I think that's pretty cleverly laid out. I don't know that was Carmine's intent, but I'm going to take it as such. The shots of the actual Justice Society, I think, all seem to have a little extra care to them. They seem to be better drawn than the rest of the book for some reason. And those are the panels that stood out to me as being superior. Otherwise, it feels a little pedestrian in some of the artwork.
Yeah, no, I will agree with that. I really wish, and this is no slight whatsoever against Joe Gaella, because I do like Joe Gaella's work and everything, but I really wish once again that it was, you know, the cover team of Infantino and Anderson, because I think those two really work well together. I love their stuff, you know, and I'm a big fan of both of them. So I think their styles just mesh very, very well. So yeah, it's a shame that Anderson didn't do the interiors on these. I wonder what he was doing during this time. I don't know, I need to look that up at some point and see. You know, maybe he was only doing covers or something. I really don't know.
Well, back then, I think both Marvel and DC had significantly smaller staffs, so that when it came time to, you know, to spread out the work, I think they were spreading their talent very thin. So I'm not sure, you know, that he would have been available to this. But I do feel, you know, and again, I actually, from everything I could tell, I think Joe Gaella was a good inker. And he did a lot of fine work, but I do feel that he didn't bring his A game to the last two issues that we covered.
I'm not overly familiar with him enough to know, you know, when he's doing a, you know, when he's bringing his A game and when he's not. He's not one of those, like, I couldn't pick him out of a crowd, you know. I couldn't, like, pick his artwork out. Like, if I didn't know this was him in this issue, I wouldn't know who the inker was. He's just not somebody whose style I'm that familiar with to be able to pick it out. Let's see, this is June of 63.
I think in the early 60s, there was such a house style that it would be very difficult to pick out any inkers. Even, say, right. Vince Coletta would be difficult to pick out in this era, or Joe Sinnott, you know, people who's inking, you know, you normally could pick out, or, you know, you didn't have people back then like Klaus Janson or, you know, Terry Austin, who really brought some style to their inking when they did it.
Right.
It was really a matter of fitting the house style. So for somebody to stand out in that era, I think it was more that they just drew a, you know, or inked a really, really clean image as opposed to adding a lot of style to it. So I don't know that I could pick out any inkers in that era.
I'll agree with that to a point that I think Anderson's the only one that I can generally pick out, because I am a big, and I think that's why I'm a big fan of his, because I can tell his style and I really enjoy it. But yeah, for the most part, yeah, I can't tell one of these guys from another in the inks. Anderson, I'm just looking real quick at his body of work on Mike's Amazing World. And yeah, he was a very busy guy. So he, you know, this would have just been another, probably a stretch too far to have him do. But yeah, just looking at 1963 alone, he's working on Brave and the Bold, Strange Adventures, Mystery in Space, Green Lantern, The Atom. I mean, there's a whole list of books. And for most of these, it looks like he was the regular either artist or inker on all these titles. So yeah, he had a full plate. So I can see why he wasn't doing also the interiors. And this is just interior stuff I'm looking at here. So there's probably a whole secondary list of covers he was doing too, you know, cover inks, because obviously he's doing them for at least some issues of the Flash. So yeah, he was a very, very busy guy. And just looking at his body of work as a whole, damn, he was a prolific artist. I mean, I knew the guy did a lot of stuff, but holy cow, I mean, it's a massive list of books that he had a hand in over the years. So, but yeah, still a shame. I wonder where the Flash, where it stood in the hierarchy.
I kind of think it was pretty high up at this point. I mean, I'm thinking he's right behind Superman and Batman, because he's the first one who was revived.
Right. So that makes me wonder then, why wasn't Anderson on this book? You know, is it a matter of Gaiella was more, you know, had more rank, so to speak, or was it a matter of Murphy Anderson just wasn't really interested? You know, I'd love to know the behind the scenes, like why was he not on this book? You know, why was
frankly,
he not?
I don't know that there was a pecking order at this time. I don't know that they had a feeling of, well, Anderson's better than Gaiella, so we need to put him on the prime projects. I got the impression that they were looked at as equals at that point. And that, right. You know, that as far as the powers that be went, as far as Julius Schwartz went, if it was up to him to assign books, he was content with, you know, let's just throw them on whatever book is convenient.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's borne out. You know, looking down the list a little bit further, the very next year, 1964, he actually did do several interiors on The Flash. He did 148, 149, 150, 152. So, yeah, he did eventually come to the interiors, at least for a little bit. But, yeah, it's just interesting because, I mean, looking at his body, it's all over the place. But, man, the guy had his hands in a lot of titles. All over the, I mean, everything from superheroes to romance to, yeah, it's all over. But yeah, interesting. Very interesting. What do you got on this one, Dave?
The cover, I wasn't so thrilled with. I looked at the cover, and the first vibe I got off of that was the Flash versus the Flash on an alien world with a flying Vandal Savage.
I'm Mary but Poppins, y'all.
But from there,
if it turned out that they said this was a different world, that wouldn't surprise me in the slightest. You know, I mean, obviously they didn't.
Right. I mean, it's the coloring.
I can see what you could see with that strange background that they have.
Even if you colored it in earth tones, you could get away with it. But on page one, when Vandal Savage is attacking the Flashes, I felt he was flying in the Delta One probe from the Superpowers line. Finally, we saw where they got the idea for that thing. The lights in the sky over DC, callback, I felt, to the UFO incident of 1952.
Yeah.
With the lights over Washington, accompanied by the no electric power, even affecting vehicles, as I said, call back to the day the Earth stood still, 1951. On page...
I want to interrupt you for a second. Shoot. I just thought of this. Did they ever satisfactorily explain why the lights show up on Earth 1 that originated... on Earth, I don't feel like that was ever really explained, was it?
That was point six I was going to bring up.
Oh, well, I'm sorry.
Why did this thing wind up showing on Earth 1 and affecting the electricity?
Yeah.
Also, at the bottom of page two, in the left-hand bottom panel, that's Ronald Reagan, I feel.
Yeah, I thought the same thing.
Doesn't it look like a comics version, like from Legends? That's Ronald Reagan. On page three, I like that the cover of All-Star Comics 37 is very accurate to what the cover looked like. They're still using the same theater as the point of entry between the two Earths.
Right.
We got an origin of Vandal Savage. Write that down. That may turn valuable in the future.
I love that the names he went by. When he was Napoleon's assistant, he was Marshal Sauvage. And then when he was working with Bismarck, he was Baron von Sauvage.
We need to keep an eye on that thing about them using that stage to cross back and forth, because I'm wondering at what point was that dropped? You know, at what point did that not happen anymore?
Right. Now, when Savage hits him with the gravity ray, which is supposed to be able to cause him to sink to the center of the planet. It seems relatively easy, though, to stop him from sinking. All you need is a rope tied around you. And... I mean, you would think you would need some force to be able to pull something to the center of the planet.
Right.
I guess we should be happy that the ray didn't just make him fat. Since this is the time we're working in, right?
Right.
I love that the wheel controller has wheels on it, and it looks like a Segway for easy transport. And we can get...
It does look like a Segway.
And we can use this to get the, you know, finally the two Flashes fighting one another.
And to run down to the corner grocer.
Yeah, exactly. I mentioned, like you did, about the... So the Flash is invisible because he's moving so fast, but if you freeze him and stop him from moving, he's still invisible.
But you stopped him while you couldn't see him.
Okay.
Somehow you maintained the not seeing.
Keep in mind, this is the same guy who worked with Napoleon and the Kaiser, so... He's not real good at picking winners in the long run. And finally... Just think that gravity device, Savage could have revolutionized the furniture moving industry.
There we go. Again, with an invention where he probably could have made more money than the evil schemes that he was doing. Yeah, exactly. Although in this one, he wasn't robbing a bank. He was trying to rule the world. But, I mean, who wants to do that? That's way too much work, I would say.
Yeah, doesn't that seem like a lot of work that if you had to rule the world?
Yeah.
I'm just picturing Vandal Savage in the role of Bugs Bunny when Bugs Bunny was with Napoleon. And Napoleon had all his little statues of his troops that he was kind of planning it out. And Bugs would be like, no, deploy them over here. And he moves them over. No, I am Napoleon. You must leave them there. And that's just kind of what I'm picturing now with Savage kind of saying, no, move them here.
You could redo that whole cover from the Justice League with the chessboard.
Yes.
Well, what else we got on this one?
I may be done.
I think I'm good. You want to rate it?
Yeah.
I'm going to go first. The cover I'm not thrilled with. It's not horrible, but it's not as good as some of the previous covers, not the last issue. I like the way the Flash looks, both of them. The background, like I said, makes it look like it's on another planet, and definitely a Silver Age planet with those colors. It sort of represents what's in the book, but not quite. And because of that, I give the cover, I give it a C+. I'm not really thrilled with it. The story's goofy, but I like the story. I like that they've kept certain aspects of it, like I said, with the theater, you know, is the entry point consistent. That's a plus for me. I like the way they worked in the popular culture sci-fi aspects with, you know, the lights over Washington, the reference to the day the Earth stood still. I love that we finally got the whole a chunk of the Justice Society actually brought back and interacting, and a pledge that, you know, we're going to see at some point these characters again.
Right.
I like the background of Randall Savage, though it is a little bit goofy. Gravity Ray is goofy for the time. So overall, I'm going to give the story a solid B+. I thought it was relatively enjoyable. The art and the story is serviceable. Like you said, the best art are the panels with the Justice Society in it. I feel like there was extra care given to these characters. And they're recognizing the historic importance of these characters. So, I mean, the negative is Randall Savage with that permanent. It's distracting. It makes me feel uncomfortable.
And I got a permanent just for the occasion.
So for those reasons, I give the interior art an overall B+ with a total grade of a solid B on the book.
I am definitely higher on the cover than you are, Dave. I like the cover. I like the layout. I agree with you 100% about the coloring of the stalactites. And actually, stalactites are fine. The stalagmites are the ones that are miscolored. And I think that would be easy enough to do. The only thing about the cover is with the two punches landing, I wish I had a little bit more feel of kinetic energy coming off of the posing. That's the only place where I really feel like the actual rendering is lacking, other than the coloring. So I think it's a pretty solid cover. In my opinion, I would say a solid B. Not quite a B+, but a solid B. The interior art, I feel, is a step down from that. I think there are some panels that truly shine, that I tried to point out, but there are a lot more that just feel, you know, mediocre. There's nothing, except for Vandal Savage's hair, there's nothing in particular that I find to be too wonky or bothersome. I could do without the flashback page being all in red, but beyond that, I'm kind of okay with everything. So my two negatives are the red background and Vandal Savage's hair. But otherwise, I think it's okay, but there's only a couple of instances where it stands out as being superior. So I'm going to give a B- to the interior art. The story, I don't think the story is really all that good. My big thing is the fact that they're bringing back the Justice Society. And I think they lose a point since 2 months later, they're going to actually have the Justice Society appear in the Justice League book. And it's not going to be the same people.
He spoiled it.
The fact that you have Wonder Woman here and Johnny Thunder, and then they're not in the other appearance. Instead, in the other appearance, we have Black Canary and Hourman. You know, give it more thought. Have it be the people who you're going to have in that book, or have the people in that book be the ones you have here. I can only think that what they decided was, well, these are the ones who were in the issue where Vandal Savage was captured, so we're going to use that. But we really don't want them to be the regular team when we when we bring them back next time. So we're just going to change it and pretend like nothing is different. I find that bothersome. If you felt strongly enough that you needed to have Our Man and Black Canary, then add them to the seven you have here. Make it nine. It's not that big a deal.
Which would have been perfect because the teams are unbalanced in that next book, too, that we're going to look at, the first JLA, JSA. The teams are unbalanced because it favors the JLA. They have more members in that.
The only reason I can think of to do it is because they had Wonder Woman on that team and they were virtually the same character because they had the exact same look.
Yep.
And that's the only reason that I could see why they wouldn't have wanted her there. You know, the other characters that are getting mirrored, you know, Green Lantern, and the, you know, it's the costume is totally different, so it's kind of okay. But yeah, I have a problem with the it bothers me that they changed the characters. I would like to have seen a steady lineup. Anyway, I didn't actually give a rating to the story. I'm not going to give them credit in my rating for the fact that they brought the Justice Society back, because I think the rating has to be how they brought them back and what the story is. So I don't feel the story is particularly well thought out. I don't think it's exceptionally well written. I think it's more of a nostalgia piece, just saying, oh, we're going to bring back Vandal Savage, we're going to bring back the Justice Society, and otherwise we're going to do the same run-of-the-mill crossover between Jay and Get Barry that we did in the last issue. So I'm just going to give a C. I'm going to let them edge up to a C plus on the story, but it's almost grudgingly. And I'm going to give the book overall a solid B, but most of that B is based upon the fact that the Justice Society is bad.
I really like the cover on this one. I like it quite a lot. But that said, I agree with you that this looks more like an alien landscape behind them. I didn't get the sense at all that this is like Carlsbad Caverns or wherever the hell it was supposed to be. I didn't feel like it was underground. I felt like it was above. It looks clearly like it's above ground with just like weird growths all around them or something. So, yeah, you have to bump it down just a little bit for that. But otherwise, I really like it. I love the body language. I feel like you do feel the power of the punches there, especially with Jay Garrick's hat flying off and everything. Honestly, the biggest thing for me that kind of brings it down a little bit. Now, granted, it is inside the book. So bonus points for everything that's on the cover here, for the most part, is represented in the story. But even so, Vandal Savage just looks goofy right there where it's like he's going, Eureka! You know, it's just really weird. It's like, yeah, he's having like a Mary Poppins moment or something where he's like leaping into the sky or descending by his finger or something. It's just really kind of silly looking. But otherwise, I really like it. I think it's a really cool cover. And I think while this isn't necessarily considered like an iconic cover, I think I have seen this homaged before. Like other people have done, you know, takes on this particular cover, I think. But yeah, I really like it. I'm going to say I'll say a solid B on the cover. I really do like this cover. I think it's pretty dynamic. And I think the colors really pop nicely as well. Interior art, yeah, you know, it's okay. It's not bad by any means. It's just, again, it comes down to, I wish the inks were a little more consistent, a little more solid. I really honestly just wish it was Murphy Anderson. But for what it is, for the most part, I really enjoy it. I think Vandal Savage looks goofy as hell in every one of his appearances in this. I just do not like this character model for him. And overall, as a character in this, he's a little silly and he's a little goofy. He wasn't yet the cool Vandal Savage that he would become, because eventually he becomes one of my favorite villains. But a lot of kudos for the fight. When the two Flashes fight, I feel like that entire sequence is very dynamic. It has kind of a stupid ending to it. But overall, I really did enjoy the fight. I thought that was very well staged and very well pulled off. But overall, the story has a lot of just like, what the hell moments. A lot of goofiness. A lot of things that just happen but are not explained. But anyway, I'm sorry. I was talking about the art. The art, overall, I really enjoy the art. So I think with the art, I'm going to go, I'll go a B minus on the art. I think it could be shorn up a little bit. It could be a little bit better, but overall, I enjoyed it quite a bit. Story-wise, though, there was just too much goofy stuff. So I think C plus is more than generous as far as the story goes, because like Paul said, I think without the Justice Society in this story, I think you've got a pretty run-of-the-mill issue of The Flash otherwise. So, yeah, it's really them being in it and the big return of them that makes the book what it is. So with all that added together, I will say I'll say a solid B minus as a grade on this one. Overall, I really did dig it, though. I thought it was fun, but it's fun in that like goofy Silver Age kind of way.
I think I hit on it in my synopsis, you know, that you mentioned about how the fight ends goofy. And in the synopsis, I said, you know, Barry wins because old.
Yeah.
Like that's the answer is, well, Jay is older, so he's got to lose, which Jay, you know, I would have liked to have seen them play that out a little bit more and have it be, yeah, Jay doesn't have quite the stamina or even is a little slower than Barry, but his experience somehow carries him through. I think I would have preferred it if Jay actually won the fight because he somehow outsmarts Barry.
Right. He's been at the game a lot longer.
Yeah. So I think that would have been cool.
Yeah. No, I agree with you on that. He should have. You know, he deserves to get, you know, his moments as well. I do like something I failed to note in my art grade on this. I do like that Jay, I think, is drawn thinner. You know, a little more gaunt in this one than the prior one. So it gives more of a feeling of, you know, an older guy, you know. He's
I don't know, the older I get, I don't get thinner.
Well, you know what I mean. I mean, he's not
frail. Like that frail or older.
Yeah. Yeah. He's not a muscular superhero. He's much thinner. He's yeah, kind of frail in that old man sense. So I do like that. I think that was a nice touch artistically, because I noticed that because when I'm looking at the other members of the Justice Society, none of them look particularly aged. They still look like they're in their prime. And by this point, they should be, you know, they should look older, same as Jay, because I would think that they're all contemporaries, right, for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So it just kind of stood out to me that he is, you know, the one that looks aged, whereas the other ones really don't.
It just occurs to me, on the page where he's trying to trap Barry, but Barry realizes that it's a holographic image. The holographic image, you know, it looks like the actor who played Blackula. I don't even know what that actor's
name
is. I know
who you mean. Yes. Yes, yeah. You're right. Yeah, I have no idea that actor's name, but I know exactly who you mean. Yeah, yeah, he does. He just looks so goofy through this whole book. He really does. That panel above.
But if you were a vampire, it would be okay.
Yeah, that panel above that one is just kind of creepy, where he's like looking at the reader and it's like, don't look at me like that. Makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah, I think you're right in your take that this is not the cool Vandal Savage that we will one day get.
Yeah, he becomes a really cool villain, I feel. But yeah, he's not there yet. All right, so wrapping this one up, this issue, this story is reprinted in a lot of places. So if you want to check this one out, it was first reprinted in Flash number 213 in 1972. The Greatest Flash Stories Ever Told, both the hardcover and the trade paperback in 91 and 92. Justice Society of America 100-page Super Spectacular number 1. Crisis on Multiple Earths, the Team-Ups, Volume 1, trade paperback. Showcase presents The Flash, Volume 2, trade paperback, Flash Archives, Volume 5, Flash of Two Worlds hardcover, Flash the Silver Age Omnibus, Volume 2 hardcover, Flash the Silver Age, Volume 3 trade paperback, and Flash of Two Worlds Deluxe hardcover. All those places you can find this particular story. Next time, we will be covering the big event, the very first crossover team-up between the Justice League of America and the Justice Society of America. Justice League of America, Volume 1, Number 21, also from 1963.
Be there or be square.
Or be a cube.
Which kind of fits with Vandal Savage's theme.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiMonzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.
All right, gentlemen, I think we have a show.
Hey, goodbye.
Bye.
Don't go.
Come back, Shane.
And I got a permanent just for the occasion.